Hello and welcome to America's 12-Step Radio Show. My name is Drew and this is Stepping Out. The stories you're about to hear are real. This is a 12-step meeting on the air. So kick back, grab a cup of coffee, and listen in, because if you ever wondered what was going on inside of those rooms, you're going to find out right now. We are tackling the addiction to crystal methamphetamine. Some of you people are familiar with it. Some of you are not. This is an epidemic drug right now. I mean, manufactured cheaply, running rampant throughout our country. You're hearing it all over the news, and I'm hoping to get a better sense for what that addiction's like, and more importantly, what that recovery process is like. We have a bunch of gentlemen in the room tonight that are going to share with us their personal stories of unfortunate addiction and recovery. And first up, we have Guy. Guy, welcome to the show.
Hi. It's good to be here.
Thanks, man. I'm glad you could make it. You know, if you'd be kind enough to share with the audience, some people aren't familiar with what crystal meth is and what that high is like. Maybe you could share that with some of the folks that are out there.
Well, I should tell you, first of all, that I'm not an expert in crystal meth. I'm only vaguely an expert in its effects on me.
Absolutely. And that's what we just want to know what happened to you when you took it.
Well, I had kind of a two-pronged recovery story. I came into AA quite a few years ago and had a stretch of sobriety. And I'm a garden variety drunk, so mm-hmm. I was like, which is, so when I had that stretch of sobriety, I really felt I'd kind of gotten into the clear. There are a variety of reasons why I strayed away, but I want to get to the crystal meth part.
Sure.
It was so different for me from alcohol. Like, alcohol just kind of whomped me.
Mm-hmm.
But crystal meth, the first time I did it, I was given it looked like this kind of innocuous white powder. It didn't seem all that big a thing.
And you were in sobriety with your drinking at the time?
Well, I was in sobriety for about 10 or 11 years. And
wow.
I should say we don't have enough time to kind of make the segue into the using of the crystal meth. But I think, you know, it was really almost, to me, it was almost like taking a kind of mild amphetamine, I thought. It was sort of just to kind of keep me more alert or something. So I wasn't afraid of it. It seemed kind of innocuous. It was a very sexual drug for gay men. I think it's one of the things that gay men really have experienced it to be. It just seemed to make my life more manageable, not less. It made me feel more alert. It made mm-hmm. me feel more attractive and brighter and just kind of on, you know.
You weren't conflicted with it being in sobriety?
Well, I had gone through – I'd kind of moved into psychoanalysis. And in fact, I was going to an analytic institute then. And
okay.
I kind of felt generally that, you know, I appreciated all the stuff I learned in 12 steps, but it just wasn't kind of scratching the itch. It wasn't really telling me as much as I wanted to know, and I felt that I was getting more from psychoanalysis. So I sort of drifted away without realizing it, and I stopped going to as many meetings and stuff. But I think for me it was also because there were parts of my own life and personality that I hadn't explored yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't like to demonize this entirely.
Sure.
It was a kind of movement, I think. Actually, my experience, as horrific as it turned out to be, was—I was lucky to have it be an illuminating one. But it began as kind of a sexual drug,
okay.
And the only thing I realized at the end of it is that I was madly in love with my sexual partner by the morning, which had never happened before.
Okay,
it intensified emotion in a way that I'd never experienced before.
Now, I'm somewhat naive to this. I've heard this frequently that it's just extremely prevalent with gay men. Is it also with gay women as well? Is it just in that community?
Again, I can't speak for that. I just don't know enough. My experience is that it's not entirely gay men, because I know a number of women in the program, but it's largely a gay male.
It just seemed sort of fascinating.
It kind of, you know, without sounding too elitist, it did kind of get picked up by the best and the brightest in a way, by extraordinarily accomplished people who then maybe gave themselves permission to explore some really dark places, which eventually I did. I think it's a very insidious drug. It really is. It's unbelievable, really, how powerful it is, especially in the way that I didn't know it was screwing up my life.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I really didn't. And I'm a writer, and I was fairly successful in sobriety in AA. But slowly, every job I had began to crumble, and I had all kinds of excuses for
Why?
It. I think because it slowly, it's like a dissociative drug. It kind of like it severed me from shared realities, you know, more and more and more and more and more until I just cousin, you know, I kind of wasn't in the same world that everybody else was in.
That's interesting, though, because you talk about how close it made you to your lover at the time and how at the same time.
It wasn't a lover, I have to say.
Okay.
Like many gay men in New York, I was quite promiscuous, and this drug really, really reinforced that, in fact. In fact, it's a hugely sexual drug to gay men in New York, and so it was not just a lover. It was many different men.
But it brought you closer to these folks, and yet it still kind of detached you,
it was an odd intensity. It was an intensity in the moment. Like, at that moment, you never were more closer to a human being in your life, and then it wasn't there. So it was very ephemeral, you know.
Sure.
But the awful thing about it, slowly what it did was just it really eroded everything, just as I think every addictive substance tends to do. It just eroded everything in my life, you know, to the point where, I remember going to a friend of mine's wedding, a woman I'd known since childhood. And when she saw me, she burst into tears because I had become so gaunt and so kind of horrific looking.
How much weight did you lose?
Oh, Lord. I was down to about 138,
oh,
and that's
wow.
not good for me. Yeah.
No.
And I thought I looked hot. I mean, I thought it was great. You know. And you know, and we sort of have a genius for surrounding ourselves with people who will reinforce our own view of ourselves. Everybody I knew thought I looked hot, too,
right.
except my one dear friend who saw me, and she burst into tears. You know, so... It's a very strange drug, in terms of hygiene, like my apartment just kind of molded. It was like a mouse hole after a while. In fact, I had mice. I used to think that was bohemian, you know? and I stank, and it was really a horrific thing. But for me, in an odd way, see, I don't like to demonize it entirely because it did acquaint me with certain, I don't know, kinds of experiences in a way that have. That I'm not so unhappy that I had, but mm-hmm. but at such a cost, at such a toll, and mostly at the toll of my, you know, not to sound too dramatic, but of my soul.
Of course,
it was a spiritual diminution there are many worse kinds of death than the physical.
Sure. But if I may ask, I mean, you had that experience, I assume, with alcohol as well, where you...
Well, it was a different experience, and that's an interesting thing for me, too, because I find that after alcohol, the kinds of qualifications that I remember giving were very much more about what my past had done to me and my family and everything.
Sure.
With Crystal, it was a little different, because I did have this stretch of kind of growing up in a certain way. With Crystal, I didn't hate myself, which is not the experience of a lot of people I know. Like, I didn't go through that same thing. I think what I discovered is that I wasn't only addicted to this very addictive drug, but I was addicted to intensity.
Mm.
I looked for intensity. I wanted something that would just, you know, blow me out of the water. And that's not necessarily so bad, that addiction to intensity, but I had no way of managing it. None.
Right.
So it really became a spiraling down into a hell that I really
relatively really, cheap drug too, I imagine.
Well, cheap, except that when you do it to the exclusion of all else, it's expensive because you don't have any money left. I mean, I was completely penniless, you know.
What were you spending a week on this stuff?
Oh Lord, I don't know. I mean, I was getting it, you know. I was just from these awful sort of drug dealers who would come to the door, and it was mostly God knows what it was made of. I mean, at the end, you know. But it was odd. It brought me to a kind of spiritual bottom that. And despair that I can't begin to describe.
Right,
you know,
right.
But for which I'm grateful. You know?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it led me into an experience of recovery that's quite remarkable, too.
You were taken by this incredibly powerful, incredibly seductive drug that just all of a sudden lied to you, told you you look great, told you everything was fine, yet it robbed you of everything that was important in your life. Mm-hmm. It's basically, is that a fair synopsis?
No, that's exactly what happened.
You were down 130-something pounds? And
I was very...
And you couldn't see it?
Very lean. Well, I thought I looked great.
But you couldn't see that the addiction had you? You couldn't...
Well, what got me to the moment of understanding that I couldn't do it anymore had to do actually with a sexual connection I had to someone I was really sort of fixated on, and I think because of circumstances of the last time I saw him, there was more than one person there, and when he left, I realized it had never happened, you know, in some basic way. All of the things I thought were happening hadn't.
Hmm.
It was all in my head. And the whole house of cards just toppled, you know. And I thought, I said these words, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore, you know. And it was a very profound thing. Now, and what is very humbling about it, as you know, as I said, I did experience a wonderful stretch of sobriety mm-hmm. in AA. I had hit real bottom as a garden variety drunk, you know, back this is back in 1985. And I was very humbled, and I couldn't do it then either. I think what, you know, that sort of segues into this sense of humility that mm-hmm. is just crucial to recovery for me. And it's not, it has nothing to do with being abased or humiliated. It has to do with being clueless, of truly not knowing. And when you know you don't know, except you can't stand your life as it is, you're in a condition of life that's conducive to reaching out for help.
Because
you don't know. But you're in pain.
Right.
So, and since I had, since I was aware of the 12-step process because I'd undergone it, you know,
sure.
you know, through a lot of years of my life, I did know where to turn. But I have to say every moment was humbling because despite all of the recovery I'd had before, I'd actually written about recovery and stuff. It was a big part of my life. I was in love with my recovery. None of it really mattered at that time. At that time, what I had to do was absolutely from square one, had to begin all over again. So I had no, I couldn't have any pride about anything because I was too gutted out.
Did you ever hear of Crystal Meth Anonymous? Or was that available?
Oh, I'd known about it. Yeah. See, I'd been pretty deeply into the whole kind of recovery community in the city, you know. So I knew.
You knew it was out there.
In fact, you know, there were a lot of people who thought I was still sober. You know, I just, you know, it was lies of omission. I never brought it up. You know.
Well, you weren't drinking.
Well, I wasn't drinking. Yeah, that's one thing which is interesting. I never picked up a drink.
Right.
I just didn't really know. that's a pretty lame, you know, reason to be proud, really. Except that I'm glad, you know.
Right.
I suppose. But what I do want to say though, this was I got sober about a month and a half before 9/11, and that was an interesting time to be in early sobriety in New York. And I think what I realized, what I was, the only thing I could possibly be grateful to for this is that I saw that my determination to be sober was happened sort of irrespective of anything else that was going on in the world. This really was my private thing. Nothing in the world was going to change my desire to live consciously, which is my synonym for sobriety, you know, conscious living. But I had no money, you know, and I had no job. And I was really forced, as it were, to move back home to the South Shore of Long Island where I was born, to my mother's house. So, there was a whole other reason for humility, you know.
Yeah.
What I didn't realize, my mother was 84, but I didn't realize that she only had a year and a half left to live. And so fortuitously, as it turned out, I went back and I had one of the most extraordinary years and a half of my life. And they didn't have CMA in this small town on the South Shore, but they did have AA and kind of, you know, blue collar, heterosexexual, kind of Irish
old school,
Catholic,
yeah.
AA, old school, you know, they ended with the Lord's Prayer, not the Serenity Prayer, you know. And I went every night, night. And I lived, it was like a kind of enforced rehab that I'm very grateful for now. But the thing I learned there was that in becoming a part of my mother's life and becoming her friend and taking care of her and taking care of the house and doing things I hadn't done since I was 18, like mow lawns and rake leaves and shovel snow and deal with the plumbing, you know, I was caring for somebody else. There was somebody else in my life. It wasn't all about me. And this in concert, I think, with the work I was doing in going to meetings and in step work, it was teaching me to send my energy outward, always outward. And that, I think, if there's one thing I can sort of lay claim to having learned, is that that's what I always need to do, even when I'm alone, is send the energy out, send it out, you know. And as a result, you know, of caring for somebody else, of having somebody else who's actually in your life rather than just you, I mean, an odd and wonderful dividend is that I've became comfortable in my own skin because I wasn't thinking about myself. So when you're in an activity, you're not thinking about the person who's doing the activity. You're thinking about the activity.
So that's what they mean when they get into the whole gift is in the giving thing.
I think it really is. Yeah. But it's so interesting because I think it's misunderstood often because it sounds so pious and it's just, but it's not like that. It's a much more active experience. of it's a participatory thing. You exist in relation to the world. And once I understood that, I started to kind of enjoy my life. And at a time when it was really an interesting time to start enjoying my life, because my mother got congestive heart failure, and I saw her through her death. Had I not been there, she wouldn't have been able to die at home. She wouldn't have had the death that she had. It was a life-altering experience for me. And I've having come back to New York, which I love, I'm a different man. You know, I hate to say it, I kind of became a man. You know, I don't like that notion, but I feel like I kind of became a human being, maybe. You know, and life is a very different kettle of borscht than it was when I was doing Crystal, or even at the beginning. You know, I mean, I'm still.
Sure.
I mean, every day is a new day, but there's a kind of, you know, essential humility, by which I mean a cluelessness. I don't know, therefore I need help. I think there are two poles of recovery. You can't do it alone, and the buck stops here.
Mm-hmm.
Both are true. You need people, and you have to do what you have to do.
Right.
You have to do your part and reach out for help. And whenever recovery goes to one pole or the other, you're in trouble, you know? So it's a... meetings. You know, meetings teach you to listen without having to conclude, without having to bolt, without having to defend. You can just sit in the chair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a pretty glorious way to live.
How long is it now, Guy?
I'll have 5 years in a month.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. You got anything real quick you want to say to anyone out who's wrestling with this illness?
Go to a meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go to a meeting. Stay put, huh?
Yeah.
Good stuff. Guy, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
All right, once again, you're listening to America's 12-Step Radio Show. My name is Drew. This is Steppin' Out.